Deuteronomy chapter 16 is a rather expansive portion of the fifth book of Torah. And this is going to be a little bit longer than normal lesson by about 5 minutes today so we can get everything in. And it begins with describing something that's very important to me, the biblical feasts. In particular, the three major pilgrimage festivals. Then this moves into discussing the requirements and expectations of the civil and governmental leaders. And then finally, it renews some instructions concerning proper worship practices as well as reiterating some banned ones. Now, as always, we have to keep in mind the context of this book in general. And that context is, here is Moses making his final address to the people of Israel, because in only days he is going to die. He knows this. And as he stands before Israel on the mountains of Moab that overlook that beautiful Jordan Valley and the long hoped for permanent home for God's people, if there is one underlying theme that Moses is attempting to project, it is probably best summed up by the words of one of Israel's most notable kings, Solomon, son of David. In the book of Ecclesiastes, King Solomon reaches this conclusion in chapter 12, verse 13, after his long essay on the meaning of life. He concludes it all by saying, "The end of the matter, all's been heard, fear God. Keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." It's that simple. The whole duty of man is to obey the commandments of God. I want to show you something. The word used for man in Hebrew is Adam, and it means man or mankind in general. So in the sense of this verse, it means mankind as a whole. This verse is not limited to its Hebrew audience. It's referring to all Gentile and Hebrews that worships the God of Israel. Now, I point this out because it's been a tendency of believers to want to make some laws and commandments only for Israel, others only for Gentiles, and we tend to be kind of arbitrary about which is which. Let's always remember that God's written commandments are contained in his law. Yeshua said, "The law has never ceased, and it will not." Until when? Heaven and earth pass away. What Moses is saying applies to us, Messiah's ecclesia, Messiah's assembly, congregation, just as much as it did to the Hebrew people in general. So let's read Deuteronomy chapter 16 together. Please open your Bibles to Deuteronomy chapter 16. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, you can find it on page 215, 215. Observe the month of Aviv and keep Pesach, Passover, to Adonai your God, for in the month of Aviv, Adonai your God brought you out of Egypt at night. You are to sacrifice the Pesach offering from flock and herd to Adonai your God in the place where Adonai will choose to have his name live. You're not to eat any chametz, any leaven, with it. For 7 days you are to eat it with matzah, unleavened bread, the bread of affliction. For you came out of the land of Egypt in haste. Thus you will remember the day you left the land of Egypt as long as you live. No leaven is to be seen with you anywhere in your territory for 7 days. None of the meat from your sacrifice on the first day in the evening is to remain all night until morning. You may not sacrifice the Passover offering in just any of the towns that Adonai your God is giving you, but at the place where Adonai your God will choose to have his name live. That is where you are to sacrifice the Passover offering in the evening when the sun sets at the time of year that you came out of Egypt. You are to roast it. You are to eat it in the place Adonai your God will choose. In the morning, you will return and go to your tents. For 6 days you are to eat matzah. On the 7th day there is to be a festive assembly for Adonai your God. Do not do any kind of work. You are to count 7 weeks. You're to begin counting 7 weeks from the time you put your sickle to the standing grain. You to observe the festival of Shavuot for Adonai your God with a voluntary offering which you are to give in accordance with the degree to which Adonai your God has prospered you. You are to rejoice in the presence of Adonai your God, you, your sons and daughters, your male and female slaves, the Leva'im, the Levites, living with you in your towns, and the foreigners, the orphans, the widows living among you, in the place where Adonai your God will choose to have his name live. Remember, you were a slave in Egypt. Then you will keep and obey these laws. You are to keep the festival of Sukkot for 7 days after you have gathered the produce of your threshing floor and winepress. Rejoice at your festival. You, your sons and your daughters, your male and female slaves, the Leva'im, Levites, the foreigners, orphans, widows among you, 7 days you are to keep the festival for Adonai your God in the place Adonai will choose. Because Adonai your God will bless you in all of your crops and all of your work. So you are to be full of joy. 3 times a year, all of your men are to appear in the presence of Adonai your God in the place where he will choose, at the festival of Matzah, at the festival of Shavuot, at the festival of Sukkot. They are not to show up before Adonai empty-handed. Every man is to give what he can in accordance with the blessing Adonai your God has given to you. You are to appoint judges and officers for all your gates in the cities Adonai your God is giving to you, tribe by tribe. They are to judge the people with righteous judgment. You're not to distort justice or show favoritism. You're not to accept a bribe. For a gift blinds the eyes of the wise. It twists the words of even the upright. Justice, only justice, you must pursue, so that you will live and inherit the land Adonai your God is giving you. You're not to plant any sort of a tree as a sacred pole beside the altar of Adonai your God that you will make for yourselves. Likewise, do not set up a standing stone. Adonai your God hates such things. I said at the beginning that I just love the Feast of Israel. That's because they are central, not only to Israel's worship practices, but to establishing their identity, and I think ours, as a people of God. The 7 biblical feasts are among what the Lord calls his appointed times. These are cyclical events. They're based on the calendar that Yehovah has established in order that Israel would have cause to pause and reflect on just who they are, who their God is. Of these 7 feasts, 7 biblical feasts, 3 of them are especially important, and their importance is emphasized by the commandment that the Hebrews are to make a pilgrimage, a journey, to the location of the central sanctuary in order to present themselves before the Lord on those occasions. And since the Lord's presence was seen as residing above the Ark of the Covenant, then to present oneself to the Lord meant that one had to come to the location of the Ark. Where was that? At the tabernacle, later on in the temple. By law, it is the adult males who are obligated to make these pilgrimage journeys. Their home's distance from the sanctuary is generally no excuse to forgo these 3 yearly festivals. We've already seen that all of these pilgrimage festivals are family occasions, so the entire family is urged to come. But that's left to the preference of each household. In reality, the family regularly accompanied the males because these were very special and anticipated celebrations that everybody desired to be present for them. Now, while so much of how Israel lived and operated was quite similar to how their neighbors did it, the act of making a pilgrimage for a religious festival to God was not a known thing in that era. These 3 pilgrimages marked the Hebrews as a different people who worshiped a different God in a different way from all the other peoples and nations. The Hebrew word for pilgrimage is chag. Chag. And some 2,000 years after the Lord mandated these 3 yearly pilgrimages, a new and rival Middle Eastern religion was formed that incorporated the same idea. It was called Islam. In fact, Islam borrowed the Hebrew word for pilgrimage, so in Arabic, their pilgrimage is called a Hajj. Now, although we've had several lessons on the biblical feast, we're going to spend some time with these three pilgrimage feasts of Deuteronomy, as there are some aspects of them that aren't readily apparent, especially to Gentiles. Even more, since virtually every great happening, hear me, every great happening in Christ's life centered on one or another of these pilgrimage feasts, then we ought to immediately suspect that the timing of them was no coincidence. The first feast that is discussed in chapter 16 is Passover, Hebrew Pesach. In verse 1, Israel is told to observe the month of Aviv and to offer a Passover sacrifice to God because this was the night that Yehovah redeemed Israel. He freed Israel from the clutches of Egypt. I want to pause and make a point here. When did God redeem Israel? When did he redeem Israel? I just said it. When was it? Somebody say it. At Passover in Egypt, right? Did he redeem them at Mount Sinai? No. When they arrived at Sinai, what condition were they in? Redeemed. Not too tough, right? Who did he give the law to? A redeemed people. Keep that in mind. If we were to point to one thing that graphically identifies the people of Israel as set apart for God, which also stirs the very depths of the souls of Jewish people, it has to be Passover. It was that act of saving Israel from Egypt, setting them apart as an identifiable people group, with God, with Jehovah as their God and King, this is what established them as a nation of God. Aviv is the Hebrew name for the month that Pesach is to be celebrated. It literally means New Ears of Grain. The reference to grain indicates the agricultural connection of this celebration that moves in parallel with the Exodus from Egypt connection. Aviv corresponds to our modern months of March, April. So we're dealing with a springtime season. Aviv is also the first month of the Hebrew religious calendar. Now, I mentioned last time that we should not confuse the Hebrew religious calendar year with the Hebrew civil calendar year. That because the civil calendar makes Tishri the first month of the year. In the religious calendar year, Tishri is the seventh month, which, by the way, is the fall season. So while Aviv begins anew the cycle of the religious calendar year, the first day of Aviv is not New Year's Day. Rather, the first day of the month of Tishri is Jewish New Year's Day, start of the new civil year. So why does God ordain this separate religious calendar year with Aviv at its beginning? Because it was the month of Aviv that marks the official beginning of Israel as a set-apart nation, and the Lord is the God of that nation. Aviv marks the beginning of Israel. Let's recall that the reason that Passover is called Pesach, Passover, is because on a singularly dreadful and yet wonderful night, the Lord himself passed through the whole land of Egypt. He killed the firstborn males of animals and humans of every household, except for those folks who trusted him. And so they followed the instruction to sacrifice a yearling lamb and to paint its blood on the doorposts of their homes. Those families who did that as an act of obedience and submission to the God of Israel, these were primarily but not universally Hebrew families, were not touched by death on that night. And this devastating divine judgment cause Pharaoh to finally understand he couldn't maintain his grip on God's people any longer. The following morning, Israel massed together in the land of Goshen, that fertile delta region of Egypt where most Israelites were residing, and with Moses leading, they marched away from centuries of slavery and oppression. Now, while I'm sure that in English, Passover will always be called Passover, in reality, the Hebrew word Pesach, as translated, doesn't mean Passover. It comes from the verb Pasach, which means to protect. Therefore, in verse 2, where we read, "You shall slaughter the Passover sacrifice," what it says in Hebrew is that you shall slaughter the Zevah Pesach. Literally, it means the protective sacrifice. Now, is that appropriate? The protective sacrifice. It's referring to the fact that Israel was protected from God's final and deadly plague upon Egypt. It was only the result of that protection that one could say then they were passed over. And that name Passover is kind of stuck since Jerome translated the Latin Vulgate version of the Bible in the 5th century AD and he chose the term Passover to translate Pesach. Now, rabbis have long recognized that there are differences between the way the very first Pesach was observed in Egypt and the way it was thereafter celebrated. Now, before I demonstrate some of those differences, I want to point out something that confuses Christians and Jews alike about the Passover celebration. Pesach, Passover, is just a one-day feast. And it's to occur every year on Aviv the 14th, or as it was later called in the Babylonian Tug, Nisan 14th. The following day, Aviv 15th, that begins another and different seven-day biblical feast called the Feast of Unleavened Bread, Matzah. Then in the midst of the 7 days of the Feast of Matzah, yet another biblical festival occurs in an overlapping fashion. That one's called Bikurim, First Fruits. That happens on the 16th of Aviv. So in rapid succession, we have Passover on Aviv the 14th, the start of Matzah on Aviv the 15th, and then First Fruits on Aviv the 16th. And while Passover and First Fruits are just one-day event festivals, Matzah goes on for 7 days. And so First Fruits happens during the time of the Festival of Matzah. Now here's the thing. Because these three springtime biblical feasts are so tightly interwoven, because the feast that sits in the center of the three is called the Feast of Matzah, it has become standard practice to refer to the entire bundle of three feasts as simply the Feast of Matzah, unleavened bread. But what makes the whole thing more problematic is that it has become just as common traditionally to call the entire bundle of three feasts Pesach, Passover. Because the Passover is so symbolic of Israel's passage from Egypt. Do not think, by the way, that this is simply about our modern tendency towards bumper sticker theology or sloppy biblical scholarship. Nor is it the result of Gentile church errors in understanding the Hebrew language. Far from it. Long before Christ's era, these two names, Passover and unleavened bread, Pesach and Matzah, began to be used interchangeably by the Hebrews. Therefore, not surprisingly, that is exactly the way that the New Testament deals with the springtime biblical feasts. One time, the Gospels will refer to the single day of Passover as Passover. Another time, it will refer to the entire bundle of three feasts as Passover. One time, it'll call the first day of Matzah plus the following 6 days the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Another time, it'll call the entire bundle of three feasts Matzah. Confusing? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, you bet it is. And that is why one must always look at Holy Scripture, Old Testament and New, from a Hebrew mindset. Existent especially in the era that those certain passages were written. Otherwise, we're going to wander off into the weeds, thinking something is simple and straightforward, when in fact the meaning is buried deep within Hebrew culture, thought, tradition. I'm going to be giving you some examples of that momentarily. But first, let's get back to the differences of the way these three spring feasts were celebrated on their inauguration in Egypt, as opposed to how they were going to be observed out in the wilderness, and then how that would change again once they got into the land of Canaan, and then how these observances evolved over the centuries as the Jewish people dispersed into a Gentile world. The original Passover in Egypt was observed in the home. The firstborn of each household behaved more or less as the family priest, although that firstborn son didn't hold the title of a priest, he wasn't regarded as a priest, and so usually he led the various rituals if he was old enough. It was the firstborn who appropriately slaughtered the lamb in Egypt and painted its blood on the doorposts of his family homes. First, because it's his job. Second, it was his life that was going to be protected by this act. Now remember, the firstborn was the only family member that was in danger, because it was only the firstborns, by definition, meaning of the firstborn son in that family, who was going to be threatened by death at the hand of God. Everybody else was fine. While Israel was in Egypt, there was not as yet an official priesthood established. That was going to happen in Mount Sinai, a couple months after they were redeemed and then left Egypt. Yet many of those Hebrews in Egypt had a distant memory of certain religious rituals that were handed down from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and so they followed the customs of that era by each family recognizing the firstborn male present within each household as the officiator over whatever traditional rituals that they retained. So while the original Pesach was to take place within the residence of each family, once the law was given to celebrate it as an annual observance, the condition changed. Now, the Pesach sacrifice and the eating of the sacrificial lamb was to take place only at the centralized sanctuary. That is the meaning of the words in the second verse, where it says the sacrifice is to take place at the location where the Lord establishes his name. In addition, the Levite priests became the sole authorized officiators of sacrificial rituals. So they then replaced the firstborn sons as the spiritual leaders of the families. The next difference between the original Passover and those subsequent to it are that the sacrifice can be from an animal flock or herd. This means it can be lambs, goats, even cattle. The passages of the book of Exodus, when discussing the required animal, say that it must be of the flock, meaning a sheep or a goat. The rabbis have had a really difficult time with this, and generally they have simply decided it would be best to follow the original instructions, which was to use a lamb. Now, some of the reasons stated for these differing instructions are that a sheep or a goat would be suitable for the amount of meat needed for a typical family of around 10 or so individuals. But once Israel settled in the land of Canaan, it would be possible for a number of families then to share one larger animal, maybe like a cow. Further, the general evidence is that because Egyptians much preferred cattle to sheep, and since the Hebrews, as far as we know, raised sheep and goats and not cattle at that time, it would have been necessary for a Hebrew to buy a cow from an Egyptian for that sacrifice, something that really would not have been appropriate for what was about to occur on that Passover night. Be that as it may, the use of the lamb as the sacrificial animal became the generally accepted practice, and the use of cattle was limited to other kinds of required sacrifices that usually occurred at the tabernacle and temple during the same time that the biblical feasts were occurring. Verses 5 through 7 spell out the need for bringing the lamb to the central sanctuary for slaughter under all circumstances. But it also establishes the time of day that on the 14th of Aviv, Nisan, that the slaughtering is to occur. It's to occur in the evening at sundown. Now, I want to be clear as to what this means, because it's going to lend much to our understanding of just what happened at Messiah's death and resurrection. In the evening at sundown means at the end of the day, but before darkness sets in. Now, the reason for this requirement is simple. First, this is how it was done in Egypt. Second, the Hebrew 24-hour day is counted differently than it is in the Western culture. In Western culture, a clock measures a day. We don't go by the position of the sun in the sky, or whether it's darker or lighter outside. We don't care. We long ago arbitrarily established a time called midnight, 12 o'clock, as the moment at which one day ends, the next day commences. That's not a biblical day. It's not when days ended and began in the Israelite or Middle Eastern culture in general. The Hebrew and therefore biblical day ends at sundown, which of course is the moment at which then the next day begins, a new day begins. Generally speaking, it came to be defined as that instant when the sun set over the horizon and then a certain grouping of three stars became visible in the evening sky because the sunlight had diminished enough now for them to be seen. So our problem is always to reconcile the Western day of our time with the Hebrew day when reading about when certain things happen during the day in the Bible. So the point of this passage in Deuteronomy is Passover lambs must be slaughtered towards the end of the day on Aviv 14th at the tabernacle, but before it becomes dark enough for a new day to begin. Obviously, if they waited too long to begin slaughtering the thousands of lambs that would be involved, the day would change from the 14th to the 15th, and now the law would be broken. Therefore, when Israel settled in Canaan and they began regularly observing Passover, scores of thousands of people would show up at the tabernacle, temple, and they would wait until towards the end of the day for their lambs to be slaughtered with the help of a priest. In time, the logistics of slaughtering all those scores of thousands of lambs in such a short time span at the end of the day became impossible. So a shift in the definition of the word, of the meaning of the word sunset was instituted. And since the Hebrews marked midday by the sun reaching its zenith in the sky, its highest point in the sky that we call noon, then from that point forward, the sun is beginning to set, right? It was rising till it reached its zenith. Now it's setting. We would call that time 3 p.m. Yeshua's days, it was about 3 hours after the zenith. That's when the slaughtering of the lambs would occur. Generally speaking, it ended about 6 p.m., about a 3-hour window, because since it was the springtime, in the springtime, the day would change to the new day somewhere between 6:30 and 7 p.m., by the way we measure today on a clock. That's assuming we're in the same latitude as Jerusalem. One other important difference in the celebrations between the very first one in Egypt and all the later ones is that the first Passover had no connection to agriculture. It was all about the Exodus from Egypt. Later, the element of agriculture was added to it. I want to talk about that for just a moment, because when we discuss Shavuot, which most people know as Pentecost, I'm going to fill in some additional information that's going to help bring some pieces of that together. The agricultural element was added to the Passover bundle of feasts by the ordination of a feast called First Fruits, and that occurred the second day after Passover. The usual explanation for this is that the first of the barley harvest, the first of the type of grain, barley, that would ripen in the fields, was brought in on First Fruits, and then several weeks later, there would be another harvest. This time, however, it would be wheat that ripened later than barley did in the season. Technically, First Fruits was not indicative of the beginning of the barley harvest. Rather, the procedure was that a sheaf of unripened barley, green barley, would be brought in, given to the priest, and he would wave it at a tabernacle ceremony. Some days later, when the barley actually did ripen and turn brown, that's when the harvesting would commence. The exact day that the actual harvesting commenced obviously varied from year to year. Any farmer knows you can't set a day of harvest in advance on a calendar. You have to wait. You have to observe when the grain or the fruit or the grapes or whatever has actually achieved the exact point of ripening is at its optimum. And of course, it's going to randomly change every year. You don't know. So the First Fruits feast day observance on Aviv 16th was really more of a pre-harvest festival. It was a day to anticipate the soon coming barley harvest. It was not a time when the harvest was actively occurring. So the first of the actual usable harvest was presented to the Lord. In fact, the rabbis explain that by bringing the not yet ripened sheaf of barley before the Lord, they were beseeching him to give them a good harvest. At this point, they didn't know yet what the result of their harvest might be. Now, while I've listed some differences in how the Passover feast was observed from the original to the later times, for the most part, the ritual has remained the same, at least for so long as the temple stood. For instance, the lamb was to be roasted over a fire, and no part of it was to be left raw, and none of its bones were to be broken. But perhaps the most symbolic of that protocol that was never altered is that only unleavened bread was to be eaten alongside the eating of the lamb and for the entire period of the combined feast days. This gives us a good segue into a discussion of another feast that begins on the day following Passover, which is called the Feast of Unleavened Bread, or Matzah. Now notice how in Deuteronomy 16:8, we simply pass from Pesach to Matzah without it being even highlighted. We move from the Feast of Passover right into the Feast of Matzah, of Unleavened Bread, without a break in the passage. There it speaks of continuing to eat unleavened bread during the whole time of the feast. The end three spring feasts is marked, the end of the three spring feasts, by the way, is marked with a special gathering. And this gathering doesn't take place at the tabernacle. It takes place in small groups, back in whatever village or town each family lived. I want to back up and summarize it just a bit to kind of get us re-leveled. The 16th chapter of Deuteronomy is primarily dealing with the three God-ordained pilgrimage or Chag festivals, the Feast of Matzah, the Feast of Weeks, called Shavuot, and the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot. The first is a springtime feast, the second is a summer feast, the third and last one is a fall feast. However, I've been talking to you so far only about the springtime feast of Matzah. The confusing part of this is that the springtime feast of unleavened bread itself is part of a three-feast bundle of feasts: Passover, unleavened bread, and first fruits. So don't mix up the name given to the bundle of springtime feasts that occur in rapid succession with the three rather spread out pilgrimage feasts that are the main thrust of this chapter. So far, we're only discussing the first of the three pilgrimage feasts, the springtime pilgrimage feast of Matzah. Now, of this bundle of three springtime feasts, it is the feast of Matzah that's actually the pilgrimage feast. Passover is not technically a pilgrimage feast, nor is first fruits a pilgrimage feast. However, since one is required to journey to be at the tabernacle for the feast of Matzah, it pretty much follows that the Passover lamb is to be slaughtered there the day before Matzah, as well as much from a matter of practicality as anything else. Now, let me add one more important element that explains why, even though Passover is not a pilgrimage feast, that it was still a requirement that the Passover lamb had to be slaughtered at the central sanctuary. Back in Leviticus, God declared that the first day of the Feast of Matzah and the last day of the Feast of Matzah were something special. They were Sabbath days. Not the Sabbath day, seventh-day Sabbath, seventh-day Shabbat. Rather, these were special Sabbath days when no regular work was to be done so that they could be preparation for the feasts. And since the first day of Matzah was declared a Sabbath day, the laws didn't allow a Hebrew pilgrim to travel on that day. Catch 22. Therefore, the Israelites had to do their traveling to the tabernacle some days earlier than the first day of the Feast of Matzah, which was on a V15. That means they automatically were at the tabernacle or temple on a V14th, Passover, or some days earlier usually, to avoid traveling on the Sabbath day on the V15, thereby making it necessary that it was at the tabernacle where the lambs were going to be slaughtered anyway. In other words, if it was necessary for you to travel to be somewhere on Wednesday, but for some reason travel on Tuesday was not possible, you'd be forced to travel and arrive on Monday or earlier. For the Jews, that one day earlier was the Feast of Passover. So there was no other choice but to slaughter and cook your lamb at the temple. So it all worked together. I told you this was complicated. But hang in there with me, because if you ever hope to understand, I mean this from the bottom of my heart, if you ever hope to understand what went on with Christ, the Last Supper, his resurrection, you need to understand what we're discussing here. It's all based on this. Okay, I want to talk about this Sabbath matter for a moment. Generally speaking, there are two kinds of Sabbaths. The weekly seventh-day Sabbath we call Shabbat. Then the various extra Sabbath days that were assigned to biblical feasts. They were not only different kinds of Sabbaths, but also what was prohibited and what was permitted for each kind of Sabbath varied. The seventh-day Shabbat is an entirely different observance than these additional special Sabbath days that were attached to feasts, and they were created for different purposes. The word Sabbath doesn't mean so much to rest, you know, kick back, put your feet up. It just means to cease. It means to stop doing the work you normally do, from which you make your livelihood or you accomplish your regular household chores. It means to stop your creative efforts. It doesn't mean you have to lie on a couch all day. That sounds so bad, though, really. It doesn't mean you can't play with your children, your grandchildren. The seventh-day Shabbat that occurs every week had the most stringent of all the Sabbath requirements, that it even included not preparing meals, because that's how it was observed in the wilderness when God fed the Israelites with manna. Recall that on the sixth day of the week, the day before the Sabbath, Israel was to gather double the amount of manna, cook it, prepare it however they chose, in order that they would eat that extra portion without any further preparation on the seventh day. Shabbat. These additional Sabbaths that were attached to the various feasts had different requirements. The requirements for some of them were more rigid than for others. The requirements for the extra Sabbaths attached to the springtime feasts were that on these particular Sabbaths, food preparation could occur. Gathering up animals that one might bring on the journey and other preparations for travel in order to arrive at the temple in time to sacrifice could occur. Some of these festival Sabbaths didn't even begin and end at the normal start and stop times for a 24-hour day. Some might begin the moment the day changed to the festival Sabbath day, but end by noon or partway through the next day. At other times, a particular festival Sabbath might not start until noon or thereafter. So there's a lot of variation in this. I want to again affirm, when I say this, I'm not talking about the seventh-day Sabbath. Its schedule, its rituals are fixed firm, and it doesn't ever change. The festival Sabbath days are additional days where the work schedule is modified or it's limited. And preparation for the coming biblical feast to which they were attached were authorized by the Lord to continue in varying degrees. It's important we recognize that when the scriptures are referring to the special feast Sabbaths, they're different than the standard seventh-day Sabbath. Now, I want you to notice, since Passover, which is how many day event? One. And then the Feast of Matzah, which is a how many day event? Seven. It begins one right after the other. So we have an overall spring feast period of 8 days. This means, follow me, that during this festival period, at least one seventh-day Sabbath was going to happen. Depending on the year, 2 seventh-day Sabbaths could happen. Therefore, the purpose, the festival Sabbath days, the special Sabbath days, would be in addition to the one or maybe 2 seventh-day Sabbaths that occurred during that 8-day feast period. I want to wrap up today's lesson by applying this to Yeshua's last Passover celebration. I'm only going to go so deep with this, we're just going to peel that onion back another layer and another lesson. But in the Gospels, we find that Yeshua was killed, put into a rocky tomb, and arose during the springtime feast days. We are unequivocally told he died on Passover day, and he arose on the first day of the week. We also know that there was at least one Sabbath in between those times, one Shabbat, the kind of Sabbath that's the regular seventh-day Sabbath. Christian tradition is that Passover and the year Yeshua died was on a Friday. This is why we have Good Friday. Therefore, we have a traditional Christian observance. We say, this is when he was crucified. See, there's a problem with what that traditional Christian schedule has come up with. It is that the story of Jonah, being in the belly of the fish for 3 days and 3 nights was supposed to be the pattern of the time period from Jesus' death until his resurrection. Christian and Hebrew scholars and teachers, myself included, have attempted all kinds of ways to figure out how we can turn Friday night and Saturday night in the tomb into 3 nights. Good luck. But no matter how we attempt to get around the problem, if, as is usual, we have Jesus crucified on Friday afternoon, going into the grave before Friday night, arising at about sunrise Sunday morning, we just can't get past the obvious Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday morning problem. We can't cram 3 nights into that scenario, although there's been some pretty creative attempts to try it. This is where our understanding of how the feast days worked and this is according to Scripture, by the way, not conjecture, and how the various kinds of Sabbaths worked, that helps us out. But there's one more important piece of information that's been glossed over that is perhaps the key to the whole thing. It is that during Christ's era, there were differing traditions among the Jews on when and how to do Passover. In fact, there were exactly three different traditions, all in operation at the same time. There was the Judean tradition, meaning the one that was observed by those who lived in and around Jerusalem in the kingdom of Judea, it was called at that time. Then there was the Samaritan tradition for those who lived in Samaria, the central portion of the Holy Lands. And finally, there was the Galilean tradition for those who lived up in the Galilee, the northernmost area of the Holy Lands. The Samaritan tradition revolved around their belief that Mount Gerizim was the place where the temple of God belonged. So, the Samaritans broke loyalty with the Judeans. They built their own temple. They established even their own priesthood. This involved doing things just a little different than what the established protocol, the Jerusalem temple, was that we're far more familiar with. The Galilean traditions were almost identical to the Judean traditions. The Galileans recognized the authority of the Jerusalem-based priesthood, so they recognized Herod's temple in Jerusalem as the proper place of sacrifice. But the Galileans had a problem. They were quite far from Jerusalem, so traveling there was more difficult. It took longer than those Hebrews that just lived in Judah. The Galileans had to begin preparations for the pilgrimage feast, especially the pilgrimage feast, earlier than their Judean brothers. So they tinkered a bit with the feast schedule, including when the festival Sabbaths began and ended, and what was permitted and prohibited on those special feast Sabbath days. I want to cut to the chase. Think about it. Where was Yeshua from? The Galilee. Yeshua was a Galilean. All of his disciples were Galileans. They naturally observed the Galilean festival traditions. It would have been unthinkable for them to do anything else. The Judeans were somewhat understanding about these distances that had to be traveled by the Galileans. So they allowed for their slightly different traditions to accommodate this difficulty. But they didn't care for a couple of other additions that both the Galileans and the Samaritans made to the Passover rituals that had little to do with travel distance and times. They added, the Galileans added, an extra ritual celebration that the Judeans did not recognize. They added a celebration called Seudah Mafsheket. And it happened as the day was changing from Aviv 13th to Aviv 14th. Now remember now what day was Passover? Aviv 14th. Also remember that that day changes at about what we would call 7 p.m. in the evening, at least for that time of year. In this celebration, the Galileans put an emphasis on the firstborn aspect of the Exodus, calling to mind that it was the firstborn Israelites who were protected from death, and the firstborn Egyptians who were killed. So the Galileans declared that Aviv the 14th, the day of Passover, was to be a day of fasting for firstborn sons of every family in honor of the Lord saving their lives. However, they also added in a ritual meal that occurred at the beginning of Passover, Aviv 14th, called Seudah Mafsheket. And since the Hebrew day changes at sundown, it's tough, I know. The Hebrew day changes at sundown, The first meal of the new day for any Israelite was dinner, what we would call dinner, right? The evening meal. For a Westerner, our first meal of the day is breakfast, because it occurs after the sun rises. So if the firstborn sons of the Galileans, and some say of the Samaritans, would have a meal to begin the day of Passover, a dinner meal. Then they would fast for the next 24 hours until it was time for the official Passover Seder meal. I want to repeat that so we're all together. I know, a little bit difficult. But what I want to get across is this isn't conjecture. This is not some new modern interpretation I'm giving you. This is found in the ancient Hebrew Mishnah, fully recognized by religious Jews. By the way, this added celebration of having a dinner meal to start out the day of Passover that is called Seudah Matzechet literally translates to, get ready for it, Last Supper. Does that ring any bells? The Last Supper title for them meant this would be the Last Supper for a newborn, for a firstborn Hebrew who lived in either the Galilee, maybe Samaria. They were going to fast now for the next 24 hours until the Passover meal happened. And then they'd have that along with all the other Hebrews. Boy, I hope the mental light bulbs are starting to go off here. It's long been recognized in antiquity that there were two Passover Seders, so to speak. The one that was the night before Passover, the other one that was the night of Passover. It's the one that occurs on the night of Passover that Jews celebrate today, and that Christians are pretty much aware of. However, since the details have been buried deep in the bowels of Jewish historical documents, the realities of this dual Seder, so to speak, that's my words, and how the two meals differed, and who participated in them, and why, and what was served, all that's been overlooked. I think this is enough to digest, speaking of meals, for one day. Think about this carefully over the next several days. Maybe go back and read about Christ's crucifixion in the Gospels. And next time, I'm going to lay out a timeline for you that I think will untangle a lot of the mystery about the death and the resurrection of Yeshua at Passover.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.